subregions.
Yep.
And it should have an ability to say that those subregions are actually equivalent to other subregions. Or do you see that that equivalence actually lies in a different object?
Sure what you mean by a subregion being equivalent to a...
If I have a point in a sort of superregion, and then that's... I may also list an element in that superregion, which may be up for discussion. That point in the superregion is equivalent to a point in the element region, the element subregion.
Yeah.
So can that equivalence go in the sort of, where does it get mentioned in a specific object that's an element point link, or can it be made more generic to say that certain subregions of a region are actually the same item? So could the superregion mention that the element point and its region point are the same item?
Element point in the region.
I guess I see the element point is just a sub region of the element.
Okay.
Or is the element point special in some way?
That's sort of trying to generalize the idea of a region, and a point is just another region, right?
Yeah. I guess I'm just trying to.
So if you've got an xi point in an element, that's an interpolation of nodal parameters for an element. So that xi is always referenced to the element of its region.
Yep.
The element parameters are themselves material points in a host element. You're always referencing there.
So I confused. It sounds like you're saying element parameters are points. What were you trying to say there?
I'm just wondering if I'm trying to understand what you're saying.
Yeah, sure.
And we're saying that we've got some xi point defined as whenever we refer to anything real about that point, we're doing it by an interpolation of some element parameters.
Okay.
But those themselves are now, this element is really part of a larger region.
Yeah.
Where, you know, that point is always itself obtained by the interpolation of a larger. This guy here is always, so in other words, if your external world coordinates are defined, this is an interpolation of that, that is an interpolation of these ones.
Yeah, that's more dealing with the embedding of fields, in particular embedding of geometric fields. I think what we're trying to deal with here is something even before that, that's the topology. So the idea here is that, you know, geometry aside, you've got a topology which is defined by the elements, their sort of shape and dimension, and the ways in which those elements are tied together. So, in a sort of simplest way of dealing with that, you could have you could tie them together only using points. So you identify points on each of the elements, and then you have a mechanism for saying, well, these points are equivalent. But you really want to be able to do that in a hierarchical sense, because it would be really nice to be able to have topology defined, you know, which is based purely on elements, right? But then to make use of that topology as a construct, as one of the components in a larger topology. And I think that's what we were talking about here. But the question is, okay, it's very simple, it's very straightforward, well, relatively straightforward to define topology in terms of points. But then there was a question last meeting, well, can't we define a topology also by sharing other higher dimensional objects, like we share, elements might share faces or lines or even volumes.
And now I was saying that there may be a global, some sort of global concept like a surface or a line that you want to embed both of these points to. So we've established a local topology.
Yep. For them there. So each of those points are well defined within each element.
And now we're also saying that there's some external reference, again topologically.
Yep.
Associate
these guys with that. Yep. Yep. Yep.
The major theme you're getting at.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So is that embedding? Constructing a new, more complicated topology based on simpler topologies or meshes. So. We discussed this earlier on, that it would, you know, that process needs to be, you know, right from the start, a hierarchical process. In the simplest case, you know, maybe you'd want to have a library of portions of meshes.
Yeah.
And you'd like to import those, join them together somehow, and the original sort of idea was simply join them together via shared points, right? But then that mesh, of course, could be imported into something else.
Actually, that idea is in fact relevant to something we're thinking about at the moment, and that is the idea that if you have a muscle cross section, which has got, you know, might have some sort of parameterization. Like that, say defining a muscle cross section. But now you want to set up a simpler interpolation over this whole region.
Yep.
Which is maybe consistent with kinematics on the boundary only, but you want a simpler representation of stress fields inside.
Yep.
Then you could map those four external points to these guys.
Yep.
With some other basis function.
Exactly. Yep.
Now you do have a topological mapping that's independent of the coordinates.
Yep.
Which would require that sort of...
And that's the whole rationale for being able to say this mesh and this other mesh here are covering, you know, the same space or the same region in a topological sense, you know.
The implication here is that the surface of one is the surface of the sphere, and that the volumes are the same.
Mm.
So the idea is that you may want to solve muscle mechanics problems where the kinematics is really important, so you've got to get the anatomical description of the muscle and preserve mm-hmm. volume. You know, as you contract, you want to make sure that everything's behaving kinematically correctly. But you, in the end, you're not that concerned about the detailed stress distributions. You want to... Sometimes you may want to compute them, other times you may want a much faster way of extracting a force for the whole cross-section.
Yep. And have a subset of those, field values then being used as the sort of coupling between the two.
When things are tied together by points, at some stage does that mean there's going to have to be sort of an assumption that the fact that these two points are shared, their adjacent face is shared also? Or
well, that was what we sort of started to touch on last week, right? And
And
I promised that I would have a think about that to see how it could be done, but I got to admit I've been thinking about that for the last 10 years and I can't come up with a simple way of of doing it.
Yeah.
There are so many pathological cases that, you know, stuff things up, at least with points. You know, you've got a really simple concept. There's no, you know, no sort of internal structure associated with it. You know, here's a point, and a point is a point no matter what, you know, sort of topology you're dealing with.
It's an 11-dimensional point, but it's a point.
No, they're always zero-dimensional. That's the whole point.
But if only points are specified, then is that going to be useful if we've got two objects interacting through their boundary?
Yeah, exactly. You know, so again, we were talking a bit about this last week. You know, how can we say take a heart, right? You know, the topological heart, and that's a sort of a 3D topology, if you can think of say that. But we've also got a boundary for that, and we want to have some mechanism for saying, well, whatever goes on in that heart there is only interacting with its surrounding other things, you know, lungs and torso, etc., through the boundary. And we were sort of, again, you know, trying to figure out a way, well, how can we have such a relatively high level concept as a boundary of a something being used to specify what can happen about the interactions between you know, neighboring meshes. And we didn't come up with a solution. We only came up with problems associated with that.
I guess I'm doing a bit of a catch up here, because us meeting Paul and Jane talked quite a bit, but the rest of us, I think, understood some of it, and we're just catching up now. I look at that, and my gut feel is that the reason we're having trouble is because we're not explicitly saying that the boundary is shared, and it's because we're trying to interpolate some information from points.
Yep.
So that's why we know it's more of a general way of specifying what's shared.
One way to do that is to, you know, calculate that information automatically, but there you need, and you know, you can do that if you have, say, at the element level, right? We know the element level is of the element is a particular dimension n, right? We know the boundary of that element is dimension n minus 1, and it's closed. And if we start to join together elements of the same dimension, maybe then we, you know, at that level we need to say, well, the boundary of this element is shared with the boundary of that element. Now the question is, how do you specify that? You can't do it just point-wise, I don't think. You need to have some more information about the components that are getting joined together. But if you could do that, then it becomes relatively simple, because if you say that this boundary is shared, then that aggregate now has a very well-defined boundary that is the union of all of those boundaries that aren't shared. So, and then, you know, that makes it really nice to, you know, then join those things together, because you've got a way of keeping track of all of the topology. You've got a way of keeping a track of what is the boundary of any group of elements or...
So now you're asking the question, what is it about information on that common boundary that's required to uniquely say these two guys are?
Yeah. Do we need to specify that explicitly for every object that we... that we incorporate in a region or an ensemble? And if we're going to take that route, you know, to be able to automatically determine what is the boundary of an object, and therefore, you know, how objects can interact, then I think we do need to do that. If we take the much simpler approach of saying, well, let's forget about that, we just allow people to specify how different objects interact point-wise, in a point-wise sense, you know, like this up here. then it becomes pretty straightforward, but much less powerful because, as Carl says, you know, you're making assumptions. You're not stating explicitly, this is the boundary of something. You're leaving that up to the user to you know, who's putting the mesh together. So at the moment, I'm a little bit stuck, you know, because I haven't figured out a simple way of, or thought through a simple way of incorporating that boundary information.
There are a couple of high performance mesh databases that use sort of a TSTT mesh API. I can't remember what TSTT is, Terascale or something. And they use the concept of sort of lower dimensional regions that are adjacent to a region of one dimension higher. So a volume
yep.
has several surfaces, and then you find out which surfaces are shared by which adjacency and so forth. So there has been a bit of a
TSTT.
Yeah. A good term was MoAb was the original one, but I think FMDB, the flexible mesh database, is a more developed one. But they haven't got as far as working out how to describe fields on these meshes. So
that's okay because that is that's something that we can build on top of the. I mean, the real issue here is sort of topological. So in a way, it's independent.
And they do have sort of a region, sort of a topological spec, and then a mesh spec below that. So maybe it is worth comparing what they're.
Yeah, doing. For sure.
And what about HD?
I get the feeling that they did propose a mesh API at one stage, but it was that was a long time ago, and there hasn't been any development on it. Whereas these are more recent, but I'm not sure what's happened in the last couple of years.
What's the relationship between the flexible mesh database and TSTT?
TSTT is meant to be a collaboration between a whole lot of units. They're trying to make different packages work together.
Right.
They're trying to propose some specs so you can easily join packages together. And so they came up with a mesh spec, and that's been implemented by both these databases.
Okay. Is it both being, one being flexible mesh database and the other being?
MoAb, the mesh oriented. it's on our website.
Oh, okay. Check out.
But I think FMDB is the one more to look at.
Yeah. Oh, I see. Oh, that's interesting.
Like, I remember you mentioning that earlier, and I haven't chased that up either.
Yeah, I haven't got very. I've intended to look further into them too.
They both use MPI mechanisms, though.
Well, they're intended for distributed platforms, exactly how they do it. I'm not sure what they're saying.
Yeah.
Okay, well.
So, they're sort of the issues that we're at the moment, and that seems. There's one. Yeah, I had intended to look at them at some stage, but do you feel like having a quick look as well?
Or? Yeah, no. Well, I need to. If they have, you know, tried to deal with these issues, then number one, you know, maybe they've got some ideas that we can filch, or number two, maybe they've solved the problem. We can make use of a standard. That'd be really nice.
Okay.
Carl, I had a Skype call with Chris the other day.
Oh, yeah.
And I think we talked about the relationship between his diagram and our current one. And I think we're getting closer in that he's been stressing this idea that the thing that you're really distributing are the field parameters, not the basis functions. the so I'll modify our diagram to reflect. I talked to Shane about this, and he's in agreement that we should modify it to make it clearer about what are the key data parameters that you are dealing with in a shared data distribution model. And the other thing was just that Chris is sort of reiterating his request for as much as possible for people to make documents available before a meeting so you can see them on the web and understand more about the conversation.
Okay. I intend to do that for other meetings.
Yeah. And then the third point is I might look at getting an electronic blackboard so that we can record these sort of things and make it available to him.
Yeah.
It can be done in software if one was using a computer and a projector.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There are some very nice electronic blackboards now that you can, you know, draw on it and it's basically immediately in a Word document or some other.
We use cameras. And generally, very high resolution.
Might be a cheaper option, Jeff.
Well, let's wait and see, because we're also, as we figure out how we're going to connect to this new high-speed internet, we may establish a facility for better. And there's a whole lot of things that are going to need. I think we're going to need better equipment for being able to do international links.
Mm-hmm. And so the advantage of that is we could draw on a blackboard here and it might appear on the screen.
Yeah, that's right. Mm. I won't make any buying decisions without
controlling
you guys.
Demos might just show up.
Yes, that's right.
With the issue of basis functions, the basis functions are still going to appear on all your nodes, aren't
they? Yeah, it's just more the issue of synchronization.
They're duplicated rather than...
Yeah, exactly. So the key element of synchronizing information is to do with your set of parameters. And the point that Shane was making earlier that I think took a while for people to accept, but the idea that whether your vector of values is associated with the node, the unknowing mesh, or whether it's a vector associated with a solution matrix, doesn't really make any difference in terms of the requirements of the underlying synchronization and data distribution model.
We agree on that point, is that what you're saying?
I certainly had come around to the view that common, and Shane seemed to indicate, because I haven't been at the last couple of meetings, but that was sort of accepted by the group.
Yeah, well, I'm certainly in agreement. I mean,
that was my understanding as well, but yeah, I think he did give room for Travis and others to go ahead and implement that separately and bring it back together again later.
So part of the idea there was to develop the data model and hence the API with these concepts, more, you know, very general concepts.
And it's a point that Chris has been making too, that the data distribution model needs to deal with not just the issue of field amount, but also the issue of solution.
Right. Sure.
We need to make that clearer in our diagram.
Okay.
I'm going to have to go out to any services.
Yep.
Dave, Kerry, Shane and I got together last week and we were trying to think, we were trying to work out how we could move on to something else perhaps while we're thinking about the field analysis issue. And the thing that we don't understand very much at the moment is the sort of internode communication, and so we need to do some, we'll start using that to get a feel of what the issues are.
And these are computational.
And so it's proposed that we take David's code and then it's currently on the fast equation code, and we put a LML model on it, and we distribute the cells across different nodes. The Laplacian solve would still be on the parent node for now, but at least it gives us a practice at some communication issues. And so I said I'd like to work on that, but I'd like to finish some things off that are almost finished at the moment. I was going to mention that as we do that, it's probably going to involve firstly to understand the sort of the CMV data structures that this code uses. In looking at the MPI communication and so forth, then I'll probably look into some other the ways other people have done it. So global arrays have sort of a library that's on top of MPI and it's meant to make distributing arrays more easy. I may have a look at Petsky to see how specific that Petsky really is and whether it will handle our general data structures nicely. Are there other things that we can be working on at the moment? We've got on the agenda at least what documentation systems, flag systems, code management systems we want to employ. I think it's still on the agenda, even though some of these things might have been partially decided. I think everyone has the feeling that we'd like to use Subversion just because other people seem to decide that's the way to do a centralized code management system. And so we'll pick that until we find out that it doesn't do what we want. Unless someone has some reason not to like Subversion.
On the Subversion thing, it does money, and I've started to use it. And Andrew Miller is using it as well.
Cool. And experience is positive?
Works like shit.
Good. Cool. Documentation systems. Kerry did an initial look into this and came up with either RoboDoc or Doxygen. And I mentioned to some people last week that the key difference here is that Doxygen tries to understand the code and so does some things automatically for you, and then you fill in more details around it. Whereas RoboDoc, everything has to be in comments. And so I actually looked at the RoboDoc source code and how they documented their own code, and what you end up doing is you have a prototype for a function or a definition of a function, and they end up copying the definition of the function into the documentation. And for the function I looked at, they'd actually copied it incorrectly or hadn't updated it or something. So that's the issue that you are going to have if you have your documentation a copy of your code, because your documentation system doesn't understand your code. But the problem is there's no documentation systems that understand Fortran at the moment. And so what we were hoping to do is use Doxygen, which is sort of your standard documentation system used for C programs at the moment, but they have listed that adding Fortran language interpretation is going to be one of the harder, actually it was at the hardest level of improvement to the system, because Fortran is so different from C. But I was going to look into that and see if we can, if Doxygen can be made to work at least from comments. And so even if it doesn't understand the Fortran code, can we use Doxygen and still pull out the comments like RoboDoc does? And it doesn't seem a difficult thing to do, so then it could do our C code automatically and our Fortran code would be as good as RoboDoc. So I was going to put that down as a thing that we were hoping was going to work first.
Does Doxygen have an XML tag in
it? No, the... The tags are not XML. RoboDoc's not XML either. That's very much a... you sort of put capital letters and indentation and...
What is that in Doxygen? What's the underlying?
There are a few special symbols that I...
Are you concerned whether that can output in XML format, though, for your book use rather than...
Oh, Oh, yeah, output shouldn't be a problem. I thought you were asking about how you specified on the input.
Right. No. You don't put XML in your code, but you can generate it.
And I think that actually means what's in your code looks more intuitive than if you had this code with XML.
Yeah, okay. That's kind of
the other question we had here was that what bug systems are we going to use? And I don't think anyone's really investigated this yet. Well, Kerry may have some comments.
So we have a system. It's not the system that's predominantly chosen. Recently become favorite. The current favorite of the open source community seems to be leaning towards Track on Subversion.
Track integrates very well with Subversion and sort of associates branches with bugs and so forth. It looks like a very powerful system. The only thing is it may be more powerful than we can handle. But probably my feeling with our current content tracker is it's quite buggy.
Lots of bugs and misses.
Whether that's because it has become the one that most
there we go as well.
Okay, thanks for
for nothing. Yeah.
I mean that's cool. If it was just me, I would probably change the track.
But if we're starting a new project, let's try something new out.
From experience of watching you guys, this current one is basically done by one person who seems to have strange ideas on
that
people want, and when he changes something, you take it or.
Yeah, and his release cycles, few and far between. Whilst it's pretty good, it's not as good.
Okay, so track something we should at least look into and do a super.
I think it's quite telling that the clone project itself
doesn't
use the clone collector. Cool. Uses track subversion.
So should we do a superficial investigation into it, or do you think it's already been done?
What would you like to know?
Then would you?
Have you
still use Plano? Given Track can do all that stuff as well.
Yeah, well, it depends. I mean, I'd keep it Track tied to projects that were in that subversion tree. So, for example, I wouldn't use it for website bugs or something that wasn't tracked in that subversion repository. So I think they both got their place.
Track can plug into Plano.
No. That's kind of why it sucks. Yeah. I'm not too bothered because I don't. We can happily document and put everything else in play. Track is for bug submission and developers. Really a public interface to your project. Except Track provides wikis and other things as well that just then you have to decide how much commitment to Track or to the website as well.
If you submitted any bugs on Track or followed any bugs?
I've looked up stuff.
That system seems to find what you want.
They have nice things like sort of project overviews, like a list of bugs until a particular milestone is achieved. So they have a few nice sort of overviewish features as well.
Mm-hmm. do we want to do? What else do we need to decide?
I'll just sort of say we need to further investigate track, which I don't know
if
people here to confirm
it,
but...
we've got a the same as subversion, we'll just use it until it sounds to be not good enough.
Using it seems to imply that we're going to use it for everything, because everything will end up in subversion.
Same as the subversion decision.
I think there was unanimous support for subversion.
Unanimous support here for track.
Yes,
sorry.
Three of how many people are.
One of them knows nothing about it. I'd put it down as a candidate that should be considered and possibly famous.
Yeah, and Bugzilla is another alternative, but I don't know.
The thing that I find bizarre about Bugzilla is that everything that uses Bugzilla has a different search interface. So, which sort of implies that Bugzilla's search interface probably wasn't good enough in terms of the original document. But following individual bugs and tracking duplicates and prerequisites and so forth all seems to work quite well in Bugzilla. Actually, the thing Bugzilla doesn't have is comments are always serial, and so if there's two threads in a bug, they all get interspersed. I guess a bug is meant to be one thread,
yeah.
But it's hard to reply to one person's comments. If somebody else has already replied, or if something does a simple thread sort, and you could reply to a particular item, then there's plenty of things that display mailing lists as a sorted by thread, and so. Can't see why a bug tracker can't do the same thing. I guess they just think that it's not necessary.
It's murder.
Feature request. Okay. Well, we haven't got a quorum anymore, so... what are there things we want to look at
random decision
next week?
Oh, we can get feedback from Paul on when he'd be ready, didn't we?
I think it's time to reassess membership of the technical committee.
I was thinking, who do you put down as apologies?
Well, I, for example, Chris Martin, Peter, Greg, Travis and Shane. People who have on occasion turned up plus Chris would be asked to.
So you don't see apologies in explicit list of people who have said they can't make it?
No, I think of it as the regulars who aren't here. Because if they were polite, they would have apologized.
Does anyone know where Travis and Greg are?
Travis is downstairs.
Yeah, I wouldn't call it an apology.
Yeah, I'm not sure how much more participation.
And that's fine. I'm happy for them to be involved as they're available and as they wish.
Keeping all the names on the I sort of see is suggesting how many of the group have made it.
Nick and Miriam haven't made it
No, I've never put them on since. I've never made it up.
I got an email reply from Nick saying that he'll be away until the 17th of February. 20th today.
Reply to... Yeah.
That's just the auto reply.
Yeah. Yeah.
How are they missing?
You didn't get a reply.
Are those the issues that you're suggesting? What did you mean by review whose ones?
Yeah.
Anything more to say on that issue?
Do you have a reason? I mean, it doesn't matter that there's extra people on the mailing list who don't have anything to do with it.
Well, they haven't complained about being on the mailing list, so...
Okay. They want to stop being spammed, they can ask it to be taken off.
Yep.
It's no extra work for us.
Cool.
Except we might be assuming that they read it and would comment if they had an opinion.
They never commented, I don't care.
I don't know what else to do on that issue. I suggest we close the meeting because it's hardly any people left and we don't have to talk about.